So we're going to talk about Jewish genetics today, because this is important. It's also very timely. It fits very snugly with the parsha that we've been reading and learning. A brief recap before we move forward. So there's this pasuk in the Torah, this verse in the Torah. It says, "Ki karav ilecha hadavar ma'id v'ficha uvelvavcha la'saisir." That this Judaism thing is very close. It's very easy. It's very doable. It's not hard. It's not challenging. Every one of us can and therefore should do this. Now, the thing we got stuck on is the bilvavcha, in the heart. Because it's not so unreasonable to say to a person, you could talk the talk. I don't feel like it. So talk the talk anyway. People can be told what to say. You can tell somebody, walk the walk. Do it. I don't really want to do it. My heart's not in it. Do it. People do things like that all the time. You do it. You do what has to be done. What people really cannot wrap their heads around is the idea of an interchange, that I should become a different person. How am I supposed to become a different person? I can't change myself. I can't. The leper can't change his spots. Especially, as we explained, that the Beinoni is a person who never really experiences a full change. It's the tzaddik who experiences change. It's the tzaddik who becomes a new kind of person. It's a tzaddik who no longer has an ego. It's a tzaddik who no longer has slothfulness. It's a tzaddik who's no longer lazy. It's a tzaddik who's no longer arrogant. It's a tzaddik who's no longer in it for me, for number one. For him, number one is Hashem. That's the tzaddik. The Beinoni ever struggles. And that's the life of the Beinoni. Filled with constant struggles and fighting. He's always out, looking out for his Yetzirah. At every turn, the Yetzirah is there. You master one part of the game, you're onto the next screen. And then, like Candy Crush, it's endless. So, the question then becomes, how could Alter Rebbe base his whole book, which is all about Sefer Shel Beinonim, all about ordinary people, regular people, not tzaddikim, not those who are endowed with the ability to compete in the spiritual Olympics, how can we say that this is karev? How can we say this is close? So in the previous chapters, the Alter Rebbe explained that one can harness the powers of his mind, and that through intense contemplation and meditation, a person can put himself into a space where even though he doesn't actually feel a certain way, but conceptually in his mind he's in a certain place. And we talked about these conceptual emotions. They're not actual emotions in the typical sense, but nonetheless they can be experienced. There's the pseudo-emotions, the mimic emotions, because mindfully, that's where I am, and that's the state of consciousness I'm in. Now, Alter Rebbe said, all right, so that's nice for maybe 5% of the population who are gifted with extraordinary intellectual prowess and the ability to control themselves. These are the people who have unbelievable, extraordinary samfrah. They never lose it. They're always cool. They always got it together. They always have a perspective on things. There's very few people like that. So what happens to the rest of us? How are we supposed to experience this beficha uvlevavcha? This is the key. The bevavcha. That's our problem. That's the issue over here. So the Alter Rebbe said that the answer to this question, in a word, is Jewish genetics. It's not what it's called in Hebrew. In Hebrew, it's called Ahava Misuteris, that there's this hidden love, this concealed, latent love, Shebelev Klaus Yisrael. And the Alter Rebbe said that this latent potential love, which we will see, does never really fully express itself or unfold itself. But this latent kind of feeling, this undercurrent of Jewishness, which is our nature, is a Yerushalanu Ma'aveseinu. So this is an inheritance. It's not something we worked on. It's not something that depends on our personality, on our achievements, on our affiliations. No. This is something that comes virtually by birth. And it's an inheritance. And then the Alter Rebbe said, and this is where we left off last week, and that's where we'll now begin today's lesson. We said, Sarach lahagdim ulevayr tchila. Before we talk about this Jewish genetics, or this Ava Mesuteris, this hidden love, before we talk about it in detail, before we describe it, we have to have a few things clarified. And the Alter Rebbe spelled out four questions. First of all, we have to know Shedish Ava. Where does it come from? What is the source of it? What's the foundation of it? We have to understand Inyono. What's the purpose of it? And many people misunderstand the purpose of it. This, they say, is the Pintel Yid. This, they say, is the Dot of Jewishness. And they think that the Dot of Jewishness is relevant for people who have gone to the very edge, or almost gone from Judaism, and yet somehow rebound and come back and still feel connected and don't want to loosen their hold on Judaism, even though in a cogent and everyday manner, their life is very different, living a very different life. Right? So once upon a time, the example, the metaphor of this used to be the Mesiras Nefesh, a person ready to give their lives. And Al Rebbe uses that metaphor. We perhaps could use a modern metaphor in a time when people aren't giving their lives, Baruch Hashem, that's not necessary. You know, the Leonard Cohen syndrome. The Jew who was raised in a certain milieu of Yiddishkeit, never really got it, never understood it in the mature way, left as a child or the adolescent, and ended up a Buddhist. Involved himself in Buddhist practice. And his poetry uses some Jewish themes, but the ideas are all Buddhist, they're not Jewish ideas. This is the biggest misnomer out there. People think they're Jewish ideas. It's not true. He didn't know any Jewish spirituality. I know from people who knew him. He did not have a clue, an inkling of Jewish spirituality. He did not understand Kabbalah. He did not understand Jewish mysticism. He didn't know it. He was in a different space. And yet, he felt so connected to his Jewishness. And whatever the things he would do wrong, he'd sing about and justify and compare himself to biblical figures, and they did things wrong too, so big deal, so it doesn't matter if I did things wrong. But he couldn't let go. He held fast to Judaism. He wanted to be a Jew. When he was asked point blank by a friend of mine, he said, "Are you a Buddhist or a Jew?" He said without a hesitation, "A Jew. Of course a Jew. I'm a Jew from Montreal," he said. "It's a Jew." But that's not very cool when you don't live a Jewish life. Is this what we wish for our children at the bar mitzvah? You should grow up to be a Leonard Cohen? I think not. I don't know. I wouldn't wish that for my children or grandchildren. You want your children to grow up to practice Buddhism? But they should remember they're Jewish. I'm not knocking him, a beautiful soul, an incredibly talented person. Like I spoke about in my sermon yesterday, Nebuch, a lost Jew.
A lot of inner conflict.
Enormous amount of inner conflict. He was yearning. He was a crying soul, a crying neshama. Felt very connected to Hashem. But it didn't translate into anything in everyday Jewish life. That's a problem. Now, today I was going to talk about that. What is the point of this Pintel Yid? Is it only for people who are really on the precipice of falling away from Judaism forever, and then they, no, I can't jump, I can't let go because I'm still a Jew? Is that what the Pintel Yid is? Is that the only value the Pintel Yid has? Or is this Pintel Yid business something that's supposed to influence our life daily? That means in Yonah. You know, with the Ve'echi Yerushalayim, what means Yerusha? How can you get a Yerusha? How could you inherit feelings? How could you inherit loyalty? You can't inherit these things. You can develop these things. You can nurture these things. If your father or mother inculcated that in you, maybe you have it. Maybe they'll give it to you. You can't inherit it. Inheriting means that the parents die when the child is a day old and he inherits everything. Could be a multi-millionaire, a billionaire dies when his child is a day old and that child is the richest child in the world. He has no clue he's rich. He's treated just like everybody else. But when he grows up, he'll find out that money was held in trust, and we have a legal system so people can't steal, and that money belongs to him. Every penny of it belongs to him. It's his money. That means to inherit. Inherit means the color of your eyes. You inherit that. You didn't work for that. I know some people today wear special lenses to change the color of their eyes, but this is all skin deep. You can't really change the color of your eyes. You inherit the color of your skin. You inherit your body shape. You inherit your certain things, intelligence. Whatever, feelings, temperament, these are things could be inherited. But inheriting a love for something, inheriting a loyalty, can't inherit Judaism. There's no such thing. He'll be the child of the biggest tzaddik. If he's abducted at birth, and there were such stories, he'll grow up to be whatever he's raised. Maybe he'll feel something inside him. Maybe he won't be comfortable. But to say it's inherited, what does that mean? It's Yerushalayim.
So what is the Pintel Yid?
Huh?
What is the Pintel?
Excellent question. That's what Al Rebbe is asking. Consider yourself in good company. This is exactly the question of the Alter Rebbe. What is it? What in heaven is it? Only the Alter Rebbe, in his classic style, analyzes everything and really like kind of compartmentalizes it into smaller bite-sized pieces. So we're going to analyze this through the prism of four different things. We're going to look at four different things, and we're going to try to appreciate and understand how this all comes together. And finally, Eich Nichlo Bagam Dechilu. How is fear or awe or reverence included, because it's Av Misoteres, not Yirav Misoteres. Now we know that the bird needs two wings if it wants to fly. Right? Av and Yirav. Needs a right wing and a left wing. And only when the right wing and left wing remember that they're part of the same bird, and they fly in unison, then we can fly, and we can really take off. So the concept then of Yireh is not talked about at all. The Jewish genetics, if you will, are called Ahava Mesuteres, the hidden love. Well, if it's a hidden love, what happened to fear? Fear is a bad word. I mean, it's a bad translation. It's awe, reverence. What happened to that? It's a different dynamic. What happened to that? Now, even though the Alter Rebbe spells out the questions in a particular order, he doesn't really answer the questions, at least as that's what I think, I understand from others also, that the Alter Rebbe doesn't answer the questions in that order. There must be a reason that he spelled out the questions in that order. Those are perhaps the most intuitive way to ask the questions, but it's not the most logical or effective way to answer the questions. So, by most accounts, the Alter Rebbe now sets out to explain primarily the third question. And the third question is, Eich hi Yerusha lanu? How can it be inherited? How can it be inherited? What does that mean, you inherit it? You got it or you don't? Really? You got it or you don't? Where'd you get it from? Huh? So the Alter Rebbe begins to explain the meaning of Avos and Imos. What is the meaning of that there are patriarchs? Abraham is the founder of our religion. He's certainly not a god, but he's not even a great teacher. Moshe Rabbeinu is the great teacher. He is the one who brings us all the teachings of Torah. In fact, we call him Rabbeinu, our teacher, for posterity. He is our eternal teacher. Every Jew learns from Moshe Rabbeinu. If you read the Torah, you are already Moshe Rabbeinu's student, because he is the one who wrote the words, Bereishis Bara Elokim, all the way straight through till Le'eni Kol Yisrael, from the beginning of the Torah till the end of the Torah. All 613 mitzvahs are called Torah Moshe. Malachi, the last of the prophets, maintains in one of his final utterances, prophetic utterances, that I only came for one reason, just to remind you about Moshe's Torah. That's all it is. Zichru Torah Moshe Avdi. That's my legacy. Remember the Torah of Moshe. Okay. So what are the Avos then? What did the Avos contribute? They're just historical figures. They just were like nice people who started a process. What is our relationship with them? What do they do for us? Avos, fathers, Imois, mothers. In what way? You know how many ancestors you have over the course of 37 centuries? Tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of ancestors. How could you identify that particular ancestor and say, this is my father? Says the Alter Rebbe, first let's understand who the Avos were. And incidentally, these are who the Avos were, not who Moshe Rabbeinu was. Moshe Rabbeinu is different. There are Zion Royim, there are seven shepherds of the Jewish people. These shepherds are people who are much larger than life. They loom larger than life. And these shepherds are people or souls, magnificent souls, who continue to provide, like a shepherd provides water and grass, provides nourishment. These shepherds continue to provide for the Jewish people. Think of it like a spiritual drip. They do something for every one of us. Who are the seven shepherds? Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, Yosef, and David. That's the seven shepherds. We also know them as the Ushpizen. So these are the shepherds. And everyone contributes something. So we're not talking about the other ones today. I mentioned Moshe Rabbeinu briefly. The question is, what do the Avos contribute? So the thing is that the Avos are called Hein Hein HaMerkava. They're called a chariot or a vehicle. What does that mean, a vehicle? We have in the prophecies, it's primarily of Yechezkel, but it's mentioned elsewhere also, that this idea that there are angelic creatures who serve as the Merkava. They serve as the chariot. They serve as the vehicle, so to speak, for divinity. And Ezekiel has this anthropomorphical vision of God sitting on a throne, and that's called Merkava. And there's different faces of different animals who are carrying the throne, who move the throne. And it's a euphemism. Obviously, it's all metaphoric. It can't be taken literally, chas v'sholom. But this prophecy is considered to be one of the most profound prophecies. We read it to the Haftorah on Shavuos because it is akin to the revelation that the Jewish people experienced in Mount Sinai. And the simple point, boiled down to a simple essence, is that Hashem's presence has to be housed or contained or conveyed to us in some kind of frame. Otherwise, the candle has no wick. It has no candle. We have no candle. We have energy. So in order for that energy to be, if you will, harnessed, for that energy to be conveyed, which is what we use a vehicle for, a vehicle is not only a car you drive. A vehicle could be a metaphor. That's the vehicle for you to convey an idea. Convey means the idea goes from your head to somebody else's head. It could be a way you convey appreciation. You use something as a frame to convey the appreciation. That's why they say, when it's a gift, say, it's a thought that counts. Is it really? Well, yeah, actually it is. Because the truth is that the gift is about expressing appreciation. So what if a person made a mistake? They thought you wanted this, and you didn't want it. You don't appreciate it. Then when you see they went out of the way, when you know that they gave you something that was left over, don't appreciate it at all. Even if it's something you need, you don't really appreciate it. When you realize that you found the old gift card, that somebody they got, and that they passed on to you, like, hey, man, like has that happened to you? You don't feel very good about this. But when you know that somebody thought about something, like they did research or whatever, or they kind of were listening and they know what you wanted, and then they couldn't do exactly whatever, but they did the best that they could, and they really did the best they could. It's very much appreciated. It's very special. Because why? Because you went out of your way for me. So thank you very much. Very nice. Appreciate that. So a gift is a way that we nurture emotions, feelings, relationship is developed by a vehicle of a gift. It's a vehicle. It's a vehicle. It conveyed something. It's not about the object itself. This object has whatever value it has, but it only has real value in a particular milieu, a particular set of circumstances. When it's conveyed in a particular way, then it's much more than just the sum of its parts. It's the thing that conveys the feeling. It's the thing that conveys the emotion. It's the thing that is the building blocks of that relationship. So when we talk about Merkava, we're talking about something through which divinity is transported. Here's how divinity is conveyed. So in the heavens, there's these malachim, there's these angels or faces of animals, Pnei Aryeh, Pnei Nesher, Pnei Shur, right? They have these different faces, the eagle, the ox, etc. And they are, so to speak, carrying. They're carrying the throne. The kise, of course, is when you want to sit, you don't sit up. How do you? You sit? Down, the Alter Rebbe says in Lukut HaTorah, the idea of a kise, the metaphor is, it brings you down. You sit down. So the idea of bringing godliness down, of actualizing godliness, to bring God to a lower level, to a level we should be able to appreciate. It means to sit down. That's the concept of a chair. So God's, so to speak, sitting down. He's bringing divinity down. And that happens through the Merkava. The Merkava, they are the chariot who conveys this. So who conveyed godliness in this terrestrial world? Well, let's think on a very literal level. Who conveyed godliness? What do we read in the Chumash? Vayita Eshel, Avraham Avinu. And Yitzchak promulgates godliness and God consciousness in a very different way. And Yaakov does it in a different way. But ultimately, the Avos become the eternal Merkava. Just like the angels are in the heavens, the Avos are on earth. How does godliness, also known as Judaism, become explained, become conveyed, become sent, if you will, or how does it arrive in this world? What's the vehicle? How is it brought here? And the answer is a Merkava. Because how'd you get here? I got it with my car. Shkoyach. Merkava. That's a guy. He said, how did you do in Las Vegas? He said, amazing. He said, I arrived there in a $50,000 sports car. I went home in a $250,000 Greyhound bus. how'd you get there? How'd you get there? So, how did Judaism get here? How does godliness get here? The answer is the Merkava that conveys Judaism until today is Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. And we know that tzaddikim, after they pass on, their terrestrial body is stripped away, but that doesn't matter. The neshama, once it comes into earth, it doesn't leave. It remains here. That's the meaning. The birth of a tzaddik is celebrated thousands of years after the tzaddik is no longer terrestrially alive, because the birth of a tzaddik is when the tzaddik's neshama penetrated the atmosphere, when it arrived here. It doesn't leave. Tzaddikim stick around. So Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they're the Merkava. Just like the angels are in heaven, Avraham, Yitzchak, they're God's angels on earth. Quite literally, in this euphemism. Valkain, because they become the ones who convey godliness, so because of this, Zochu lahamshich nefesh ruach neshama livneim achareim ad olam. Because they became a Merkava, because of this, they had the privilege of bequeathing special levels of soul to their children for eternity. What does that mean? So firstly, I think it has to be noted that the angels who serve as the Merkava on high did not earn the right to be Merkava. It was not through toil or effort, Nobody mocked, denigrated them. They were designed for that purpose. But Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov had enormous challenges. And they were not born Merkava. They became Merkava. And because they became a Merkava, because they modified themselves, but they modified themselves to the point where they no longer had their own independent will. What's a Merkava? A vehicle doesn't have his own ideas, unless you're watching Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But in the normal world, there's no such thing. When your car starts telling you what to do, you're in big trouble. The car or the vehicle or the bicycle does what you want it to do. It goes wherever you want it to go. It's your vehicle. It's just a vehicle. It doesn't have an independent entity. Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, they were born as independent individuals. They were born with their own individual ideas, their own individual wants, but they were so committed to Hashem through their Avedas Hashem, through the dedication to God, they actually re-engineered themselves. And the superlative was extraordinary way of a tzaddik, to the point that they no longer had their own will. It's not about them at all. It was only what God wanted. And the prime example of that is yesterday's Torah reading, the Akedah, which I heard somebody say is a dark part of the Torah. And I find it to be a ridiculous and preposterous and outrageous statement. I can't believe a rabbi would say that. How could you call it a dark part of the Torah? Something we recite every single day of our lives. Every year, the Jew Davin says the Akedah because it's a dark part of the Torah. Every Rosh Hashanah, that's what we read, because a dark part of the Torah. It's a ridiculous, secular way of looking at things. The Torah is light-filled. Torah is Torah's Oyer. And the Torah of Oyer gives us a story of Avraham Avinu becoming Avraham Avinu. When does it become Avraham Avinu? On that 10th test. So they spoke about yesterday. Hashem says to him, Bevakasha, Kachna, I'm begging you, they shouldn't say Shalayayim Mamish, that the previous 9 tests were self-expressions of self, but rather expressions of selflessness. And Avraham Avinu has to be ready. Hashem has to see that he's ready to transcend any rhyme and reason, any kind of limitation. And when Avraham Avinu is ready to do that, that's enough. That's all. Take him down. It's over now. So that's all. Hashem didn't need Yitzchak as an offering. He needed Avraham Avinu's readiness. And if you think about that, it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling that a person should be able to... It's so uncharacteristic in every single way. It shows Avraham Avinu the true Merkava. So I think the Kliyaka says, Vayishlach es yadoi. He had to send his hand. He sent the, like, he stretched his hand out with the knife. It's like somebody who sends a messenger. It wasn't even his hand anymore. It's like, just told the hand what to do. And like, a regular hand would tremble, like, you know, like just sent his hand. Like, total mastery. Total commitment. Total devotion. Like the car, like the wheels that just turn. The wheels go wherever you take it. This is who the others were. Now, I don't know if this is correct, I'm going to tell you now, but I think this is at least will help us in understanding the pshat. The latest field in genetic, this research, is called epigenetics. And you know the word epi because it's Greek, it means external. You probably know the word from epidermis. Dermis, skin. Epidermis is the outer layer of skin. So epidermis, or outer layer of skin, has another kind of epi. There are a number of different epis in science. They're labeled as epi, which means they're external things. And one of them is epigenetics. Because genetics are things which are intuitively passed, naturally passed. The parent doesn't have to think, I want to give my child such and such genetics or not. This is in the Chayk HaBeira, in the Eberstein, only the Eberstein knows how there's the mixing of the mother and father's genetics and how the child ends up with this unique cocktail. But when those genetics are given, if you have certain things, that's who you are. And sometimes it could pass generations and it remains a dormant gene and the gene comes back. You know, there was a famous violinist, his name was Yehudi Menuchin. Ever heard of him? He just died a few years ago. Yehudi Menuhin, maybe you know him as. No? Okay. Google him after. He's a very famous violinist. So Yehudi Menuchin, his parents were pretty much assimilated. And they were going, they were a young couple. They were going to get an apartment. And everything was great. They could sign the lease. And the person said to them, the best thing I can tell you, he said, there's no damn Jews in this building. He didn't know they were Jewish. So they heard that. Obviously, they said, well, we're Jewish. We're not coming to your building. And they decided she was pregnant then. They said, what do we name our child in a way that shows Jewish pride? So they said, we're going to name Yehudi, Jew. Name him Yehudi. Now, they could never know, but this Yehudi actually became a world-famous musician. World famous. He was a child prodigy. In the 40s already, people were like amazed. I think they brought him to the San Francisco Philharmonic when he was 6 years old, 7 years old. And they came to show this child prodigy. So the maestro said, what do you want to play? He said, what do you want me to play? He said, what do you mean? He says, anything you want. Anything he wanted, the kid could play. Yehudi Menuchin was five generations from the Tzemach Tzedek. The Friedrich Rebbe met this child. And he writes, Hayem Reisi Ayelad Apele, Yehudi Menuchin. Today I saw the wonder child, Yehudi Menuchin. And the Friedrich Rebbe says that when it comes to genetics, sometimes there is a dormant gene, doesn't use these words, but that's what he basically says, a dormant gene that can lie untapped for generations and come forth. He said that Tzemach Tzedek, we know, had an unbelievable kishar, an amazing gift in music. And the Friedrich Rebbe said, this is the gift of the Tzemach Tzedek. The Tzemach Tzedek's genes in music, the musical talent of the Tzemach Tzedek, were found in this book. Where was he born? The United States of America. Google him. He's a famous guy. No, unfortunately not. No. I mean, if you want to really stretch and reach, the Tzemach Tzedek is a direct descendant of the Metzudas David, Metzudas Sion, the Altshuler family. The Altshuler family has a direct paternal line to David HaMelech. Metzudas David, Metzudas Sion is directly descendant of David HaMelech. And David HaMelech, what did he do? What did he write? Sefer Tehillim. Must have been a great musician. So this is a dormant gene that can go. Could be. I'm just throwing that in. But we know that Tzemach Tzedek's father, Shaul Shachna, was direct descendant of Metzudas David. His name was Altshuler, as was the Metzudas David's name. Right? The Friedrich Rebbe used to say about the Rebbe, a dog ate at Tzemach Tzedek. He said the genius of the Rebbe. He used to say that's my Alter Zeder's genius. Like the Rebbe had the same name. His wife had the same name. It's like very chilling, like. Similarities, the way the Torah is very similar, but he said Adog used to say Adog Eid Tzemach Tzedek. He said it many times. Anyway, going back to our point, so what happens when a person, through trauma, or through effort, or through toil, whatever it may be, when a person modifies themselves, people could actually change themselves. It's possible to change yourself. You're not the same person. So what happens when you do that in a very intense way? Is that some of these things can actually get passed on genetically. And they use this in research. It's actually demonstrable that people who have a family history of addiction are prone to addiction by birth. They're prone to addiction, which doesn't mean you have to become an addict. It just means you're prone to addictive behavior. And if there was addictive behavior in the previous generation, even though addiction could be something that's acquired.
They call them markers.
Markers.
Markers
in the genes. And then, but it's not something you actually had. You don't find it in previous generations. And on a certain point in time, this is what a family started doing. It actually becomes genetic. There could be such a thing. It's called epigenetics. There are these families in Russia, circus families, who the family was in the circus and their parents were in the circus, their grandparents were in the circus, their great, like generations of acrobats. And like the children started at a very young age, and you could say it's nurture, but it also seems compelling that it's nature. It's because that's who these people become. It becomes a defining hallmark of these people. Our stained glass windows in the main sanctuary are made by a factory. Almost all of the employees are descended of employees who are descended of employees who have been making stained glass for almost 300 years or more. And they're like the biggest experts in the world today. Because the hardest stained glass we have that can't be made. There's only one company in the world that can do this. It's layers of hot glass poured one upon top the other. And you have to go a bunch of attempts till it actually works. They usually break several dozen until they get the right one. They make it shatter until they get the right one. It's not made of little pieces that are put together. It's actually sewn together when it's wet, so to speak. Layers upon layers. Right? So these people have it. It's almost in their genes. Kadaik is chapter. If you want, the Gemara says this. The Gemara says that once there's three generations of Talmidei Chachamim, HaTorah Machzeres Lachzayin Yishalah. The Torah comes back to its hosts. Which doesn't mean that somebody born of a great Talmud Chacham is going to be a great Talmud Chacham. It just means they're genetically predisposed. And genetic predispositions are nice. Can we break genetic predispositions 100%? I know a young lady who has a family history of addiction who decided to become an addiction counselor. That's what she, why? Because she knows it up front. She sees the horrors of it. And she decided, I'm going to break this once and for all. And she can. And hopefully she will. And that's amazing. And you have to give people credit to have that fortitude to be able to do something like that. We can all break out of certain things. But that predisposition is always going to be there. It's going to be a bigger fight.
Addiction? You get a predisposition
Yeah, yeah. Scientifically proven to be. Yeah.
And depression?
Depression is certainly genetic. It's not a question, it could be genetic. Mm-hmm. 100%.
You get it from your wife.
Hi, Sheldon.
Maybe your wife.
Okay, so this is, means that the Avais changed himself to such a point that they became a Merkava. What happened is that Hashem said, because you did this, 3 generations in a row, just like the Gemara says, 3 generations in a row, from now till the end of time, every one of your progeny is going to have a nefesh, ruach, or neshama, ad olam, for eternity. Me eser sfiris de kedusha, from the 10 spheres of kedusha, sheba arba olam es abiyah, from the 4 worlds of abiyah. L'chol echad v'echad, to each and every one, kifi madregosai, u kifi maisav. To each and every one, in accordance to his level, in accordance to their actions, v'al kol panim, and at any rate, afilu l'kal shebekalim, even to the most pathetic Jew, barely hanging on, the lightweight, spiritual lightweight. U'peshe Yisrael, he is not a lightweight at all. Peshe Yisrael is a sinner of Israel. This is a deep neshama, with deep problems and deep issues, and he's a deep sinner. Very different than the lightweight. He's a heavyweight, but he went heavyweight, went the other way. So nimshach b'zivugam, when they create a child, they, through the chemical act of creating a child, there becomes through that a nefesh, the malchus da'asiyah, a lefesh, which is connected to malchus da'asiyah, shimadrega tachtena, I promise you I'll explain this in a moment, I'll try to anyway, which is the lowest level of the kedusha of asiyah. Hey, this needs a lot of time. Okay. So we're out of time. We're going to continue this mitzvah show. But here's the basic premise. The basic premise is that a Yiddish neshama is not like every other neshama. A neshama, a soul, gives life. That's what souls do. Souls give life. So things which are soulless are lifeless. We could say also that a soul gives a conscience. A person has a certain humanity about them. It's also part of the soul. A normal person has a conscience. A person who is depraved has no conscience. That's not a Jewish thing. That's a human thing. There are serial murders. There are people who don't care. There are people who are cruel to the point that they delight in misfortune and suffering of others. These are sick people. These are twisted monsters. They're not animals. Animals don't do bad things like that. These are twisted monsters. And there are twisted monsters out there. So it's possible to almost uproot any vestige of humanity. And you wonder, could there somehow be a glimmer of humanity? There are amazing stories about, like, concentration camps and Nazis who killed Jews like cockroaches. It meant nothing. And then it would be like in a weird, like a glimmer of... a glimmer of humanity sometimes. They would have like an... I heard stories from people, like an ounce of compassion that didn't make any sense even.
Nobody's murderers in jail. Anyone who touches a kid or something will kill them.
Right. But they're murderers. But if you hurt a child... So there's still a glimmer sometimes of humanity under all the darkness. And on various levels. A Yid, a Jew, is not... just a human. We're like everybody else, only much more so. So we don't have just a neshama that makes us alive. We don't have just a neshama that makes us have a conscience or even seek spirituality. We have a neshama that's an actual piece of God that yearns and needs to be close to God. And as we can explain in the next chapter, this is different than every other love in the world. Because every other love in the world is about self. I love. It's about me. This love is selfless. It's an oxymoronic love, a love that makes no sense. It's a love that's totally beyond rhyme and reason. So this has to come from a framework of holiness. There's this framework of holiness. There are 4 worlds, and each of those 4 worlds, there are 10 levels, which gives you a range of 40. Now we're talking about nefesh, ruach, and neshama. Nefesh, ruach, and neshama are 3 different levels of soul. In 3 levels of soul, each one of them has 3 levels. So there's 3 levels. There's nefesh de nefesh, ruach de nefesh, neshama de nefesh. Then in ruach, there is nefesh de ruach, Ruach de Ruach, Neshama de Ruach. Then in Neshama, also Nefesh de Neshama, these 3 levels. So now you have to do the math for me. We have 40 levels we identified, because there are 4 worlds, 10 levels. In the 4 worlds with 10 levels, in each of those levels has a minimum of 9 levels. Huh? 360. Is that what it equals out to?
40 times 9 is 360.
Okay, so that means that there's a matrix. Every soul has to fit somewhere on this gamut. Somewhere in this chart of 360, it fits into one of those 360. Now, even if it's the lowest of the lowest of the lowest, which means it's the lowest level of the 4th world, which is Asiyah. So it's Malchus of Asiyah. And it's Nefesh de Nefesh. It's the lowest of the lowest of the lowest, but he's still on the chart. and he's still on the chart, that chart ultimately is all one great composite of what we call Klal Yisrael. So it's all connected to the Eibishter. That chart is naturally, intuitively, all connected. We'll explain the plumbing and the technicality of this in greater detail next time we learn Eretz Hashem. But this is the basic premise of what we call the genetics, the Jewish genetics. So you know they map out genetics? This is the very great oversimplification, gross oversimplification. But if you want to map out the genetics, the Jewish genetics, you're looking at a range of 360 possibilities within which there are possibilities and possibilities and possibilities, but everybody's got to fit somewhere in that chart. Got it? Let me continue.
Moshe gave us all something, but he wasn't necessarily...
It's a very good question. Moshe Rabbeinu is very different. Moshe Rabbeinu is not an Ovis. He's not an Av. He's not a, his contribution is not a genetic contribution. His contribution is it's different. He's a Raya. He's a Raya. This is Raya Mehemna. His contribution is he's giving us Emunah, but that's not for now.
Can you change your chart if you become a Baal Tshuva?
Can you change your chart if you become a Baal Tshuva? I don't know if you can change your chart. I think, though, you can connect to an iCloud. And therefore, even if you're nefesh the asiyah, you can connect to chachma the neshama the atzilus, which is why we're chassidim. And you're chassid to the Rebbe, so you can get into the iCloud. You connect to a much higher neshama, but it's all part of the same thing. But